set.
You're listening to
The Antioch Podcast.
Conversations about biblical anti-racism.
Have mercy.
Let me say it one more time. The Antioch Podcast.
A podcast ministry of Madison Church.
Oh, I got Jesus, yeah.
Hello, welcome to the Antioch Podcast, conversations about biblical anti-racism. My name is Eric Nykamp. This is the second week of continuous demonstrations over the death of George Floyd, calling for changes in or the replacement of police forces in the United States. The members of the Antioch team are outside of this podcast doing anti-racism work in various places, spaces, and institutions. And when we gathered, we were all very, very tired. We decided to turn on the microphones and sit down together virtually for what Pastor Reggie called Truth Talk. Let's go now and listen to this conversation. All right. Welcome to the Antioch Podcast, where we have conversations about biblical anti-racism. Before we started, we kind of thought we should give everybody who's listening a little bit of a warning that we are a bit stressed and may not be at our best. And it's been a week. So when we recorded last time, we record on Fridays. That afternoon and evening, at least in our city and the cities around the nation, there were protests. We had one as well, and our downtown parts of it went up in flames. Lots of windows got broken. The first part of the protest was really peaceful, and it devolved. We've had National Guard troops out in the streets in a number of cities nearby, and that's the case around the country. People are angry. People are sad. People are tired. People are confused. People are asking questions. And if you do anti-racism work to any degree, you've probably been over-functioning, to say the least, this week. So I'm seeing lots of head nods from you also. Did I capture that okay?
Yeah, and Eric, I was gonna say, you know, the catalyst for the uprising, revolts, riots, the videotape of George Floyd being murdered in the street at the knee of a white police officer. That on top of things that we had talked about recently, Ahmaud, Amy Cooper, right? So those were—
And today is the birthday of Breonna Taylor.
Yeah. And Breonna Taylor. So these are four events that were just like one on top of the other, on top of the other. You barely caught your breath from one, and then it was another. So when we talk about not being at our best, it's just this, it's not just that, not just plain old racism, not just all the racism that always happens every day, but this was just one right after the other, which just was like in your face. This stuff is still happening. People, and it was just, and each one just to see, it was just harder. I mean, just harder, 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 from the tangible to the intangible. It was just hard. And so, yeah, there's a lot of groaning. There's a lot of cries for justice. And yet in the midst of it all, there's still denial that racism even exists.
Exactly.
That this really isn't a thing, that if people weren't doing something bad or illegal, then these things wouldn't have happened. I mean, I was in a conversation with someone earlier this week, speaking to my campus, and one of the panelists, who is an African-American male pastor, and I had to put an African-American male pastor who is very welcoming to diverse audiences, right? Is very professional in his interactions, is a life coach, travels around the globe, you know, speaking to business and all that other kind of stuff. And he was saying, you know, right after Mott, in his own neighborhood, he was either taking a walk or doing a light jog, had a face mask on, doing a thing, saw a neighbor, waved hi, and that neighbor to him said, "Oh, are you behaving yourself or haven't they caught you yet?" And
dang. It's like,
yeah, he's in his own neighborhood wearing a mask, walking around, and a neighbor says to him, this is right after this with Ahmad, is saying this to him. He wasn't doing something illegal. He's not known for doing kind of shady stuff. He's not a shady preacher. You're in your own neighborhood. So when we talk about being tired, it's our individual tiredness, and it's also the tiredness of other people that we carry. So I just wanted to add in there. So yeah, there are all these things happening, but there's a catalyst. There's a reason why, why this kind of weariness and the weight that it has, not only for us as individuals and what we're experiencing, but as we become more aware of other people's experiences, you almost get to a point where you can't cry anymore. Almost.
If I were to break that down, what that looks like for me would be after the first situation with Amy Cooper, as soon as that came out, then there were people that were justifying and defending. And then George Floyd. And then the defenses and, you know, the justifications of why that happened. And it's like wave after wave of defending whatever the action was that was unjustified, I believe. And so when it keeps coming and it keeps coming and it keeps coming, I mean, it's tiring. It's tiring. And I think it wears us down where we start, for me, like, okay, what am I really doing here? I broke down in tears. I think it was Tuesday night. I was in a meeting and I broke down in tears because there was a part of me that was so tired. And it was a painful tired, not where I'm feeling pain for myself, but it was like this collective pain, tiredness. And then I cried again Thursday morning in a group with white women who I love dearly, and just the collective pain that is happening that other people don't really understand. And that's painful.
I was in a similar place crying Tuesday night, and Wednesday morning was just a sob. And husband knew it was bad because he said, are you okay? You know, before the sob starts happening, are you okay? And I said, no. Because usually, you know what you say, are you okay? Yes, oh, yeah. I'm fine. And I couldn't even fake it. It was like, no, I'm not. And then it's just sobbing, right? And I'm thinking, towards the end of the sobs, I'm going, how can I take care of my university if I can't even take care of myself? How can I take care of anything else if I can't even get myself together or protect myself? How can I do it? I said, it's just the weight of all this and not feeling like you can do a single thing about it. And yes, for all the good Christians who are out there who are saying, yeah, we can pray about it. I get that. I get that. Yeah, we can definitely pray about it. We should be praying about it. But when you're in it, right in that thick thing right there, whew. I mean, it reminds me, you know, Reggie, and I had borrowed your words. I did not give you credit when I had written a piece for a friend of mine where you had said, you know, it's just making me wonder, do Black lives really matter? Do they? I mean, I know they do. So I don't need anyone filling up chat boxes or anything else like that or comments. Yes, I know Black lives matters. But, you know, it just makes you question when it's just this onslaught of one thing after another, after another, after another, And then it's anniversaries of this and anniversaries of that, mm-hmm. And this and that. And then it's like, do they? I mean, someone had said, I was watching, was another Black pastor, and he was commenting on the Amy Cooper thing, and maybe it was in this group as well, but just saying, you know, if Ahmaud had been a dog, the police would have been involved as soon as it happened.
Wow.
Right? Mm-hmm. If George had been a dog, the Animal Protection Society would have jumped in there right away. No one would have let a dog, no one would have let an animal, no one would have let a grown man have their knee on an animal's neck in broad daylight on a street for 8 minutes, 40 seconds. No one would have allowed that to happen. And yet, it was allowed to happen, not by strangers or vigilantes, but by people who are sworn to protect and serve. And it was allowed to happen.
Yep.
What, how are we supposed to think of us, ourselves? How are we, it takes everything to hold on to the idea that I too am created in the image of God. Mm-hmm. Because these images don't show this. Yeah, so that's a funky kind of place. Wednesday I was, you know, on a panel, and like I said, all Wednesday morning I was sobbing and crying and trying to get myself together, because I said, I am not going on camera looking like I've been crying all morning. Not going to do that. And I was, but I wanted to do that because I wanted to speak my truth. And I was, and as I had shared with you all, I was nervous about it, not for what I would say. I was nervous because I didn't want to break down in the middle of it again. And I was anticipating the people waiting in the wings with the gotcha. You said this, but that wasn't quite right. Or when you do anti-racism work, when you do diversity work, there's always someone around with a gotcha. You say Psalms 121:5, and then they respond back, well, actually, it was Psalms 120 and 2. Or actually, you said the date was 1875, and the date was actually 1895. You said Jim, and actually it was John. You know, and you just want to say, you know what? Skip you. You know, there's always, you know, and you shouldn't have to always be on guard. And, and we don't want to be lazy, and we don't want to, you know, misquote stuff, but come on, people, we are human beings. And sometimes we get caught up in the emotions and we misspeak something. You want to say, do you, every time you speak, say, put the comma in the right place and say the right word? If you do, more power to you, but that's not me in this moment. So leave me alone. Okay, I'm talking a lot.
No, this is good. I think this is stuff that we've been carrying around, and we need to let it out. We need to share it. As you're speaking, like, I know, I can imagine what you were feeling, and because
Well, and that's what's nice about this group, and that's what's nice about having people that when you come to the table to talk, there's no pretense here, right? So Eric had, you know, shot me an email earlier and say, hey, are you sure you want to do this? Because this is kind of some, you know, if you want to say no, you can say no. And it's like, no, this is a safe group for me. And I really appreciate that, because it's not an echo chamber, because while we have similar sensibilities, we're not always exactly in the same place.
Right.
But it's okay. We're we ask each other questions because we're curious, or we want to understand how you got to that point. We don't ask questions to dismiss someone's point or someone's experience. There's been different times where we've held each other's pain, right? It's a different pain for different people at different times. And we have built enough trust with each other to do that. And we can say, you know what? Yeah, I'm not at my best today, but I want to be here. I want to be at the table. Let's go. And this kind of place isn't easy to find.
Yeah.
Especially if you are the person responsible for leading diversity efforts within your organization and your context. Either because that's your job title or you've just taken that on. Because when you are in those kinds of leadership roles, you're trying to create pathways and bring other people along and help in their education and understanding. And and here we can assume basic knowledge in this group. There's no one in this group that we have to convince that racism is real.
Thank you, Jesus.
There's no one in this group that we're going back and forth about the definition of racism, or what is anti-racism, or does anti-racism have a place in the church? We don't have to start there. So since we don't have to start there, we agree on that. We can have a different kind of conversations than we often can have within our organizations. And that's what I value about this. And that's what I hope our listeners are able to find. Find some people that you can bring your whole self to that conversation. This doesn't mean that you never talk with people who aren't as far along or who have these kind of questions. Right. Yeah, you need to do that, but for the sake of your own soul, for the sake of your sanity, you need to have 1, 2, 3, 4 of the people that you can talk to and say, it hurts right here. I hurt. And you need to be able to trust them with your pain, and we need to be able to receive their pain as well. So when, you know, I thought I was passionate about women in ministry, and then I met Libby. And when I hear her talk and break down the scriptures, it's like, oh my gosh, she should be a seminary prof.
Oh yeah. She will be.
I'm working on it. PhDs take a long time.
I know, but you're going to be fabulous, because you're a woman who embraces her identity as female, and you understand the scripture. So what I love is that you take this feminine lens to it that is not dismissive, and that is not just limited to this little, oh, this is your role. You're going to be a good wife and a good mother, and, you know, maybe not a troublesome daughter. You do much more than that when you break down the
scripture. I've been a bit of a troublesome daughter.
Well, see, I like that.
And just beginning my work as a wife, so we'll see how that goes.
But give them hail, Libby.
We'll be praying for your husband.
And even with race, you know, I won't speak for Susie or Reggie, but I enjoy when Libby and Eric bring in their whiteness. I mean, what I appreciate is that you all are mindful that you are white when you are in these spaces. Oh, I cannot tell you how refreshing that is, because you can be in spaces and people forget. They don't think about being white, and they don't think their identity matters. Their racial identity matters when they enter into spaces, because it's just normal and they don't think about it. And I think about my race every space I enter.
Right.
And so I appreciate that. And then for Susie and Reggie and I, we can bring our racialized identities into the conversation, and no one is saying, yeah, but is it really like that? or wow, you know, you're not like one of those. You're not mm-hmm. that kind of Latina. You're not like that. You're not that kind of angry Black guy, right? Mm-hmm. It's so.
Can I ask something about that, though?
Huh?
This is something I've been kind of wrestling with, is that there's a lot to be angry about. Susie, Michelle, and Reggie, like, you guys you've gotten where you are to a degree probably because you know how to hold your tongue at times. I'm not particularly gifted in that, at least this week. To be totally honest, I feel like I've blown it an awful lot. Do you ever feel it's okay to be angry? And if you do, where do you
get it? I did Wednesday.
Yeah. Thursday.
Yeah.
And Tuesday. Yeah. And Monday. You know, after last week, I am ready to give the phone camera a clear pathway to Black citizenship. Because if it wasn't for the camera on the phone, we would not have known any of the things that happened this past May mm-hmm. in 2020. And I am remarked to say that May 2020 is a date that should be marked. Because it's going to be one of those dates in American history that we're going to all have to know, or at least, well, young people are going to have to know what happened during this month. And you kind of alluded to a couple of the things that were with Ahmaud, that was in early May, but it happened in March.
Yeah.
We didn't get the video until May. And then mm-hmm. it was Breonna Taylor. That happened in March. Mm-hmm. We didn't know about it until May. Mm-hmm. And then the Amy Cooper, Chris Cooper, bird watcher versus unleashed dog owner. That was in May in Central Park. And then George Floyd mm-hmm. happened the same month, May of 2020. And if it was not for being filmed, we would have known any of those, at least a couple of those, we would not have known. Mm-hmm. And so we see this frame that's happening in which, you know, America has to be reintroduced to this original pandemic called racism. And having that layover with the actual pandemic, which is also killing Black folk mm-hmm. left and right. And now that people are starting to protest, you know, America is waking up to, well, what happened? And that to be drawn to what happened to George Floyd is more than just symptomatic. It kind of points to this moral moment that's teetering right now between which way are we going to go? And those are those moments that you can't just ignore. And yet at the same time, people of color have been weighing that burden for so many decades, and now it's exploded. Mm-hmm. And now we don't know exactly what to do with that. And yet we have a president that seems to exacerbate or almost thrives on that kind of conflict in which he could use for political purposes. And it comes back on me as a person who is working in the things that you just talked about, Michelle, is, wow, all of a sudden, white people discover me. Mm. Mm. When they didn't want to discover me 2, 3, 4 weeks before that, and now they're asking, well, what can we do? What books can we read? What movies can we see? What? Really? Really?
What goes through your head when people are asking you that? Because, like, that's been a question that I'm in three different anti-racist organizations, And that's the thing. Like, all of a sudden, it's as if people have no idea where to find resources.
Random little thing. Like, I run the social media account for the library where I work. And since I've started doing that, I've been posting like anti-racist books in our library, especially since we've gone online. I've been posting like anti-racist ebooks you can read. And I had somebody email me like, does the library have any books on anti-racism? And I was just like, yeah. And that's just such a petty little thing. Like, how must it feel like, Reggie, how many years have you been trying to get our denomination to have conversations about anti-racism within our community? What does it feel like to have people to say like, oh, now I'm listening?
Yeah, you know, and I don't want to feel guilty anymore.
Yeah.
Mm. So I want this resource so I can read it and say that I've done something.
Right.
And then I don't have to feel guilty anymore.
Right.
About it.
Right. To lower the anxiety.
Do you think people realize that anti-racism is a lifestyle and not something you do once?
Mm-mm. No.
So Michelle said that, like, you bring your blackness into every space you go into. And, like, the fact is I bring my whiteness into every space I go into, but I get to choose whether or not I'm aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, like, there is this part of my whiteness that wants to say, like, if I do this long enough, then I'll get over it and I won't have to do it again.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that there's a lot of white people that are like, okay, so I have to be uncomfortable for 3 months and then I'll be better.
You're going to do 3 months uncomfortable? Wow.
Get ready to commit to a rest of your lifetime of feeling a little uncomfortable, but you'll be better for it.
We've talked about this on here before too, and that I think a big part of whiteness is an addiction to comfort. And that we've spiritualized it. Like, we are so addicted to comfort that, like, most of the music we create now, lyrically and musically, both has like this sense of soothing to it. And yes, there is scriptural stuff about being soothed and comforted by God, but God also says things like, I'm going to, you know, fathers against sons and mothers against daughters. And, you know, I came to bring a sword. And when he's talking about being a shepherd with a crook and a stick, I mean, sometimes that's to keep the sheep healthy by giving it a whack to go away from the cliff. You know, it's like there's plenty of other aspects of God that are not about soothing. And as white people, like, I kind of feel like we take our entitlement and our, you know, all the privilege that we have, and we've kind of spiritualized it as if this should be a normal state of affairs, instead of seeing it as some of this stuff that we have, some of our comfort actually comes at the expense of other people's misery and suffering. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to look at it. So we feel completely justified in saying, I'm stressed out, so today I'm going to not go on Facebook, or I'm not going to watch the news for a while, or I just don't watch the news because it's just bad news, as if being uninformed somehow insulates us from realizing sin, and that we feel that this is a sin that's optional to deal with.
Or just thinking of the sin as it's just, well, I never say anything bad to any people of color. I have friends or associates who are people of color, and we have lunch together and we're good. So I can't be a racist. I don't participate in this racism.
Or I went to a mandated training last year for my job. I got it.
Oh wait, this is a real one. We hired a black pastor and we have a black worship director. We're good.
So I'm on a Facebook group for worship leaders, many Facebook groups for worship leaders, and there's all of a sudden all these things popping up on there. And I wish I could quote it directly, but it was something like, if we start moving our church, I'm assuming it's a white person, to try to be more inclusive, how can we do this without losing white people?
You can't.
Yeah, that's so the response I got was that, like, you won't. You'll find out that members of your congregation are deeply racist. You'll worry that your church is going to go under. You're going to find out that people you love have racist opinions that shock you, and you'll find out that you have racism yourself. And that's just focusing on you. Imagine what it would be like to be a person of color and walk into this space and all the things you'd have to deal with. You know, and
right.
You can't painlessly address racism.
Right.
Right.
Just like you can't painlessly get sober from alcohol. You just can't. You can't get sober without pain.
Yeah. If you're comfortable dealing with racism or being an anti-racist, you're doing it wrong. Everybody will be uncomfortable because there should be built-in accountability there, but you have to know what you're accountable for, which means hearing the truth, which means accepting someone else's experience as valid without trying to give the yeah, but. And it means, okay, so if the system is broken, we're no longer going to just put a Band-Aid over it. We're actually going to fix what's broken. And right. That means it's going to have to be done differently. And we're right. So used to things being done a certain way. And as you said, you know, comfort levels and invested in there. And I would say not only white people, but for some people of color as well, there's a comfort in like, I'm a part of the marginalized group. Nothing more is asked of me. I don't have to do this. I don't have to come to the table because they're not listening to me anyway. But if we're going to do this true anti-racist work, everybody's got to come to the table, which means people of color, some of those people of color are going to have to trust white people. And white people are going to have to trust people of color. And we're going to have to come and share what our own experience is, not what we think someone else's experience is, but come with what our experience is, affirm or see other people's experiences as their real experience and say, okay, so why is it like this? Okay, and why is it like that? And why is it like that? Till we get down to what it actually is. And then we have to have a want to. We have to want to do something different. That's the thing that makes me a bit nervous or concerned about the current social unrest. Because right now there's a recognition, a shock for some people that, oh my gosh, this stuff is real. That's horrible. How can that stuff happen? But then when it comes, and then say, yeah, we want change. We want justice. Okay, justice for George Floyd doesn't mean $1 million to his family. Justice for George Floyd means a change in the criminal justice system.
Some of the sticky situations I've been getting in, I've been realizing are like, I know a wide range of white anti-racists, and the young folks I'm hearing are talking about like defunding the police as much as possible and replacing it with other community intervention programs. I'm tending to hear white anti-racists who are in generations above me saying conflict de-escalation training for police. Yeah. And there's these fights going on among anti-racists about like, how radical is this change gonna be?
Yeah.
And that there's a lot of infighting among people who care, because I'm hearing a lot of young people say, no more cops, period. As opposed to, so I guess I don't know what my question is, but is that tension happening other places too, not just on my Facebook page?
I've seen both on mine.
Yeah, yeah, me too.
I've seen that. Mm-hmm. I think they're Libby, you're just highlighting that there is a generational gap in between those, and I even see this even in the Black community, that of those in the older sense that you need to organize, you need to have a plan, you need to have a strategy. That the Civil Rights Movement was just not based on, you know, there was no Facebook. You couldn't just crowdsource or crowdfund to come to Selma. there had to be an organized way in which you got people behind you. And so there had to be some, at least reaching out to even some whites in order for that to happen. Whereas even today, you know, I heard about there was supposed to be a march downtown and it was all by social media. And what happens is that you get the emotions going and you get to talk to the police chief and, but nothing else happens after that. And so there is this conversation that is going on that I think is a good conversation. But at the same time, I think that something has to get dismantled. Mm-hmm. Something has to get torn down. And when you tear down anything, it means something to the person who built it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so there's this kind of, well, I built that. Why are you tearing that down? So there has to be this, how do we help mourn what we are going to destroy?
Hmm. Yeah, that's really
forthrightness and really wide-eyedness to say that I love stability, but I can't have stability if I'm going to go into a new imagining of how communal life is supposed to be. I just watched Ulysses Grant. It was a three-part series on on the History Channel. And I was watching it with my daughters, and they had never knew anything about, you know, Grant and Reconstruction. And my one daughter was just, why didn't they tell me this in school?
Mm. Yeah.
And the amount of stuff they didn't tell us in school.
My goodness. It just, you know, you did the highlights. You know, you throw Martin Luther King in there, and then, you know, you move on. Mm-hmm. You hit Barack Obama, and then we're now at 2020. But you know, if you think about that, after the Civil War, now you have all these freed slaves, and you have no idea what to do with because the Confederacy collapsed, the whole Southern way of life collapsed, and so they had to start from scratch, and that I think that's something that we're going to have to at least start to think about. When we talk about police brutality, when we talk about police culture, we have to think about that it's probably got to be dismantled. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you got to build it. And that is usually very messy work because we hate chaos and we love stability. We love certainty. And then our sin kicks in because we want to bring it right back to the way that it was. And I think that that's where we're kind of heading towards right now with these protesters who from the young who are saying, we need change now, to the older who will say, well, we need stability now.
Didn't the Israelites kind of do the same thing when they like get out of Egypt, and as soon as they're in the desert and they're like, oh, nobody told me there wasn't going to be good food out here, you know, like that, like I was all for this march, you know, and the Red Sea, that, I mean, that was
pretty, cool.
Pretty incredible, but like this whole long walk through the desert, like that's hey, give me some good food. Like I'm used to that. Egyptian stuff is good.
This is another area where I think our schools have failed us in the way that we've talked about these social movements. So you'll hear me talk about this all the time. Like the Reformation didn't happen in 1 year. It happened in 100 years. What did 100 years of chaotic change in the church feel like for the people in the 30th year of chaos? Yeah. And this change that's happening in the United States and with every other movement, it didn't happen just in May 2020, but it was precipitated by, the last 4 years. Maybe we could say the last 10 years, the last 20 years, and it will go on for another 30 years. And when we have a larger scope of how history takes place, it's easier to keep going, but it's also harder.
Yeah, so if we were to have, you know, like a space alien come to Earth and land in Grand Rapids, Michigan, let's say Saturday, you know, they would see this like riot and all this unrest. But what we're missing, and I think this is the big piece that we're all missing in this conversation, not this conversation, but this whole conversation that's happening in our country right now, is that every police force, and I'm going to use the military as well, they are created by an ideology. There is a reason, like a thought process of, we need this because of this. So it's all thoughts putting pieces together to create a police force. And so if we were to look at the history, you know, like how did that start? And then all, you know, how it's evolved throughout time and the influences that have impacted those ideologies, you know, and we were talking about Law and Order, we were talking about Jim Crow, you know, throughout our series together. And so police officers have training, and just like in the military, we have training. Whenever there is, let's say, the riot on Saturday night, there were things that they learned from that improved them, right? So there's always ongoing training that is going on. And that's how it was in the military. I mean, we were constantly being trained. So when we're looking at the police force right now, there are a lot of different reasons why police officers respond in certain ways. You know, it's not just that one training, it's right. Ideologies and training and training and training to bring us to that point. If we were to do this work well, we really need to look at that history. We need to look at the ideologies and the influences that brought someone to, let's say, just simply put handcuffs on someone, right? Like, why do we do that? So there are things that we need to question, and we need to do it collectively. We want people to be safe. You know, we want you to protect us, serve and protect us. But we also want you to keep us alive, right? And so there are so many different pieces of this that we need to break down and really investigate and analyze.
From what I've read, it's that there was a time when there was always community policing, and that your cops were in your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You knew them. They knew you. So you saw them when they went to the store. You saw them at their kids at school. There was a closer proximity that police officers were a part of the thread of the community. And so that becomes a very easy way in order to deter or de-escalate. But then around the 1920s and 30s, that gap began to grow as policemen began to be a part of the larger system of supposedly protect and serve. And then we saw something happen in the 80s. We saw that the cops were being outgunned by drug dealers, and they began to get military wear from the military in order to have the same firepower as the drug dealers and the cartels. Well, something happened. When that began to go down in the late 80s and early 90s, we kept the military and we kept the training. And part of that training was that the person in which you will meet is your enemy. And that changes the perception that it is no longer the community in which you are interacting in, they are the enemy. And so if you come with a sense of suspicion, rather than that I can possibly talk to this person, then it is only a short jump to where it's you against me. Mm-hmm. I gotta win, you gotta lose. And we had all these other entities from cable news and pundits, and which turned it into, if you don't get tough with these thugs and these criminals, then you're weak. But if you talk to them and de-escalate it, you're weak. And so we didn't have a way of actually intervening, because you don't get more money by trying to de-escalate things. You get more money, you get more material, you get more tax dollars coming into your budget by saying, we need more firepower.
That reminds me of a conversation I had with some Border Patrol officers. I was doing some research about immigration on the U.S.-Mexico border in Arizona, and they had plenty of guns, and they had plenty of protective equipment. We asked what equipment they wish they had, and they said that they wish they had more lawnmowers so they could clear away the brush along the border so they could see better. The thing that was underfunded for Border Patrol agents was not guns, it was lawnmowers. That sounds a little bit like beating swords into plowshares, maybe? Literally? When you there's a few songs that people say, if you play it backwards, you can hear somebody saying Hail Satan or something like that. But if you if you listen to the song backwards, you don't hear it. But if somebody tells you, when you listen to this song, you're going to hear someone say Hail Satan, then you can hear it. It's like you've been primed and now you see it.
Right.
I feel like I'm watching police interactions with protesters and seeing a ton of police officers that are primed to think violence is going to happen here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they believe it's going to happen and then they see it. Rather than entering into the situation with a neutral perception, I'm just watching everybody's coming in primed to believe that destruction will happen.
Join us next episode for the balance of this conversation, where we talk about internalized racialization, dismantling racism in Fox News, thoughts about anti-racist advocacy in social media, and more. You've been listening to the Antioch Podcast. Worship well together.
This concludes our broadcast day.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Goodbye.
And God bless
you. Thank you so much.
Antioch Podcast listeners, we'd love to stay in touch. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, as well as on the web at www.antiochpodcast.org. Please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please rate and review us. Positive reviews help others find us when looking for quality podcasts. And now, for our regular post-podcast disclaimer.
You have been listening to the Antioch Podcast. The opinions expressed on the Antioch Podcast are not the official views of Madison Church, its leadership, or the denomination of the Christian Reformed Church. Madison Church is a member of the Christian Reformed Church and adheres to its doctrinal standards. The purpose of this podcast is to provide recorded examples of the kinds of conversations which we believe churches need to have in an increasingly diverse world. These kinds of conversations pave the way for a multi-ethnic congregation to design worship services with unity and justice, and truly worship God diversely together. Thanks for listening. Bye!